I am Dr. Vaughn. I'm in the Department of Mechanical Engineering over in the College of Engineering. Contact information is here. I actually will post these slides. And if you notice, I have a microphone on. I'll post some audio from this, too, if you want to reference it in the future. It seems cool to you. You can check it out. So my lab over in mechanical engineering, we do controls, robotics, and automation with respect for human interaction. That was a way to get to kind of a corny acronym, CRAWLAB, Crawfish CRAWLAB. It is corny, I admit it, but people remember this. So people remember you're that CRAWLAB guy. I'd like to give you a little bit of information about who I am, just so you can trust me on these things. I'm actually from Southern Virginia, just south of Richmond. A bachelor's degree from a really small school in Virginia called Hampden-Sydney College. It's actually the 10th oldest school in the country, only about 1,000 students when I was there. It's like 1,200, 1,250 right now. Liberal arts school, so no engineering program, no computer science. Wanted to be an engineer my whole life, though. So how did I end up at this place? First, I double majored in physics because I wanted to be an engineer. That's a good path into that. Ended up there because I played baseball. Right, and that ended up being a pretty good choice for me. And a small school worked out for me as well. I came from, if you look at all the kind of ratings people do with schools, my high school within my county was the worst one. Test scores were the worst, all that kind of poorest school in my county, all that kind of good stuff. So going through an atmosphere like Hampden-Sydney was a great fit for my background and kind of got me up to speed, and I got the attention that I needed as a student. From there, I went to graduate school, wanted to be an engineer. I was the first person from my family to go to college. So college itself was a bit of a, I don't know what the heck's going on here. Nobody really did. Grad school was the same way. Lucked into getting into a good grad school and ended up with a pretty cool advisor. My advisor was actually a national champion decathlete. So we had kind of the athlete thing in common that worked out pretty well for us. Pretty good guy. Master's degree is actually on the suspension design for heavy machinery. So how do you take a dump truck, for example, and design its suspension in a kind of an optimal way? And what we were doing that's a little bit unique about that is that we were adjusting or trying to adjust the parameters of that suspension in real time based on road conditions, loading conditions, weather conditions, driving conditions. Right? So effectively, we're changing the spring and shock absorber actively while you're driving. There's actually some high-end SUVs that do this right now. So Lexus has one of their high-end SUVs that's actively tuning suspension parameters as you're driving. Pretty cool. Got into that, at least partially. Dr. Singho's like me, and maybe like a lot of you, was the first person in his family to go to college. His mom's a dump truck driver. So he has interest in this project from a family perspective. PhD, August 2008, got into control of cranes, which we'll talk about at least one crane today, before we get into what you can do for me. Do with me. So that's all grad school. After grad school, or during my PhD, I had a chance to go to Japan for about 3 months to do some work there. I ended up really liking it and going back to work with Professor Hirose. Hirose wa chou tamagai. Ichiban tamagai. So he's a very, very smart guy. One of those type people that feels like he's playing a different game than the rest of us. So a really smart guy. Tamagai, literally in Japanese, means good head. Smart. Okay. So this robot, let's talk about this guy for a minute. If you are kind of traveling on rough, uneven terrain, what's a good way to do that? Well, kind of the hint here is what you see on this particular robot. Yeah, so legs are a good way to get around kind of rough, varied, unknown terrain. Right? There's a reason there's a huge number of biological organisms that have legs. Various number of legs. They're a good kind of robust, generalizable, if you will, work in a bunch of different types of places, low to middle collision. However, if you got to a hard surface, like this floor, like a road or sidewalk, what's a more efficient way to move around? Wheels, right? We want to be able to roll, right? You look, there's actually some pretty cool graphs. No longer versus this presentation, I have them. If you look at locomotion, how efficiently we're able to move around compared to other animals. We're way down that list if you consider running. But the second we get on a bicycle, we're at the top of the list. Right? So So that's what engineering, computer science does for us. It allows us and enhances our capabilities. So this robot, he's in the grass. He knows, or it knows, hey, this is a good place to be walking. However, we can get out to this hard asphalt surface and realize, hey, walking might not be the most efficient way to move around anymore. So it does that, and this robot was designed such that each of his feet, you'll see, is actually a wheel. Right? So it can transform into the wheels, and they're not driven, there's not motors on those wheels, so it has to actually skate. So I think this is a good example of a robot that's kind of a little bit inspired by biology in that it can walk, right? But it's doing something that doesn't exist in biology. There's no animal that can do this, right? So we're talking about design of robotics. We can use things that are inspired by existing organisms, inspired by animals or insects or people, and then tweak and do things that animal, insect, or person is not able to do, right? Professor Hirosei in the lab there is probably most famous for robots that look like this, however. It's another kind of cool system to show you guys. So this guy's a snake-type robot. Professor Hirosei was the first person on the planet to do snake-type robots that work like real snakes. They're not just faking it by driving some wheels or something. So he did that in 1972. Was the first kind of published work. He's got a pretty cool video of himself with the robot, with the big cart of all the computer necessary to make it work. And all fits inside this guy now, in that time. Cool thing about snakes and snake-type robots is once you kind of have the system, and if you can seal it up to where no water is going to get in, the control in water is not really much different than the control on land. So you kind of get, if you're able to keep the water out, amphibious operation for free, if you're able to control the snake well. So this particular model has just a camera in the nose, effectively, with that LED ring. What could we use this kind of robot for? Is there being snakes underwater? Yeah, that's fine. What was your?
Deep sea diving.
So we could do. So one suggestion was deep sea diving. Yeah, we might be able to do some deep sea exploration, some data collection down there.
If used correctly, you could actually save
fish or something. Yeah, so this might disturb the environment less than a traditional submarine would. So you could observe coral reef or do biological observations.
Research.
So there's a ton of research to be done on how this thing should be optimally controlled and those kind of things. Where else? As we're missing a big one, I think. So what happens? Some natural disaster, a building falls down. Right? People might be trapped inside. How much of that space are we able to get into to see if there are people or not? Not most of it, usually, right? Things are crushed. There's small places. This kind of robot's really good for that kind of exploration. We could send a snake-type robot into a building after some kind of natural disaster or something and try to find people that might be trapped there. So it can get to places that we can't really get to very easily, right? Same thing for kind of inspection. Small space inspection is pretty cool. My work, like I said, crane control. So here's a crane. This is actually one at Georgia Tech that we work on. Up top there is the part you actually move, and he's got a joystick. So he pushes some buttons forward, reverse, left, right, and make the thing move around. Okay. And the objective in this video is to pick this thing up and move it over, and then move it into the board and set it down. Right. So if you went to a factory, well, first question, how many cranes are there in the world? You guys know? Cranes. A few hundred million, that's right. Yeah, so there's a few hundred million cranes in the world, actually. And most of them are in factories and warehouses, so you don't see them, right? So if you think about cranes, they're actually the bottleneck in a lot of operations, the thing that slows everything down. And the reason for that is that the way cranes are controlled in production right now in factories is, one, people move really, really slowly. So you pick the thing up and you just move it really slow. And usually you move really slow and get 4 or 5 of your friends to come hold onto it while you're moving it, so it doesn't oscillate. If we don't do those things, you get some response that looks like this. So he picks it up, starts moving it. It's going kind of normal speed and not holding on to it. It can start oscillating like this pretty easily.
10 times playback.
It's fast forward a little bit because cranes are slow. Even at their fastest speed, they're slow. So we can take that same controller and understand the physics of how that crane works and design a better system. Let me actually fix that. We can skip ahead. Let's see if I can get my mouse over there. We'll go straight to this one. That'll work. So here's the same crane a bit later. This is actually a student driving it. He's highly motivated because there's a $200 prize on the line to go from here into this circle. Okay. And this kind of crane payload, this kind of long, skinny one with the weight, is really hard even for experts. So it takes this student who's working really hard and pushing the buttons a lot, almost 4 minutes, 3 minutes and 50-something seconds to get to the target. Then we just turn on our controller. 30 seconds later, same student, we could do it in 11 seconds. Again, just really by understanding the physics of that crane and changing his button pressures just a little bit. Okay. So let's talk about some more robotic stuff. Okay. So there's a robot I have over in my lab, Rujo Hall. It's a four-legged robot called a quadruped. How do robots walk around? If you ask a little kid, for example, elementary school age kid, to walk like a robot, what are they going to do? Yeah, very methodical. They're going to be kind of stiff. Right? There's a reason that's kind of the stereotype for how robots move around, because that's how they have moved around. Right? Most robots, when they're walking, are effectively stomping their feet as they move around. We've done that historically because we need the robot to be kind of stiff. We need to know exactly where my foot is when I put it down, or I'm going to fall over. Okay. And if I need to know exactly where it's at, it better not be vibrating or flexing at all. Okay? So, if I'm walking around and I'm stomping my feet the whole time, how fast am I going to be able to move? Not very fast, right? If I ask any of you guys to run, are you going to run by jamming your heel into the ground while you're running? Usually not, right? Let's say a big difference between us and kind of Olympic athletes is how efficient we're able to reuse energy in each step, right? You're going to use your muscles and legs as springs as much as motors to keep you going, right? Really no robots until very recently worked that way. Okay? We stomp our feet. So we might think about changing this leg structure in some way to where we can be more efficient, right? So our initial work in this area is actually to take the lower segment of that robot's legs and just kind of mimic what you might see like as an athletic prosthetic. You might remember the Blade Runner guy that was in the Olympics a while back. So instead of having a really rigid lower leg now, this can flex some. And if we're timing our walking the right way, we can get the energy out of that spring and use it in the next stride. So we have to change how we're asking the robot to walk around, but we also have to optimize and design how flexible this leg thing is. If it's too flexible, it's not going to work. If it's really stiff, we're back to where we started. Okay. If I asked any of you guys to jump, how are you going to jump? Are you going to have most robots do it this way? They squat down and kind of store some energy and sit there and then go. Right? Is that how any of you guys would jump? No, probably not, right? You're going to try to get some momentum going. Usually often take a little hop, store some energy, and then go. Right? These type of legs allow us to do a similar thing as well. Right? So this robot can take a kind of pre-jump, store some energy in these springs, and then time the actual jumping motion to jump. So this robot, with the rigid legs, won't leave the ground. With these flexible legs and a little bit of tuning and controller, we jump about 4 inches. But we're infinitely better, which is good. So here's this robot walking. You can see he's kind of bouncing vertically, right? You don't see the legs deflecting much, but we are storing energy. Again, these are initial versions. We're 15% faster, which is actually a big improvement when you think about energy use. So I have worked on other things I think are pretty cool. Been lucky to work on a project for some autonomous surface vehicles. It started as a project with Swift Ships down in Morgan City. Actually worked with a computer science professor here. Worked on a special forces boat called the Anaconda. So here's the boat. This boat is $1.5 to $2 million. It's kind of fun working with something that's that expensive. Kind of scary at the same time. So the idea was to make this boat autonomous. Started out by effectively making a remote control boat, and we actually used mostly kind of gamepads. So we had this little Bluetooth controller we could control it with. We'd use Xbox, PlayStation, gamepads. A lot of fun controlling a $1.5 million boat with an Xbox joystick. We also had a few simple iOS applications that were effectively just virtual joysticks, right? We did some tilt-based stuff. We also look at kind of some gesture-based controllers. So the one I'm going to show you is actually based on a system called Leap Motion. And what you'll see, here's one of my students at the time. Here's the kind of front part of the boat. You'll see he's got his hand outstretched like this, right?
There's a webcam on the laptop.
Well, there's this, so you might see here is this little Leap Motion thing, right? And actually, it's looking up. It's effectively a camera. Not quite, but for these purposes, that's close enough. So it's looking for him. First thing it looks for, you have your fingers spread out. It needs to find five fingers, right? And if it sees all five fingers, then basically it's looking at the angle of your palm relative to those fingers, right? So if we want to move forward, we just tilt the hand forward. There's a throttle, there's a brake, turn left, turn right, right? So you'll see these gestures, pretty simple gesture-based controller. Wrong way. And when you're doing it, it does kind of feel like magic. So tilt forward, and you'll see the boat. Kind of hard in this view, but you'll see a bit later. So we're going kind of slow. This was actually the exact very first time we tried this out. So we're able to steer the boat. You can see another one of my students turning the boat by just moving his hand around. It's pretty cool. So the remote control stuff's pretty fun. The idea, though, is to make this thing autonomous, self-driving, right? So we were able to do that as well. This is one of the first days we were out on the lake. This is our test lake. We dropped some GPS coordinates and drew UL in the lake with those coordinates. It's pretty cool. All that led up to taking some of my students to Hawaii in 2016 for this contest. So here's a boat we have over in Rougeau Hall. This contest, schools from all over the world came to this contest. We took a group of undergraduate UL students to it. So we have an all-electric system, two different motors. There's actually a pretty kind of interesting suspension system between the two pontoons it has. So let's put all our sensors and cameras. Cameras all the way around. Laser sensors on the front. Pretty cool system. So here's a video of it in Hawaii, one of the days. So right now, it's actually under remote control. We're getting in position, and then the idea, what it's supposed to do, we'll switch over to autonomous control, is go in between the red and green buoys up there. So we switch over some point around here. And she actually has trouble in this trial, right?
It's auto control?
It looks right around this time we switched over, yeah. So it's self-driving. Cameras on the front are trying to find the buoys. We don't know the GPS coordinates of them, actually. So it's trying to correct its motion to drive through those kind of two gates. And you see the kind of current's pretty strong on this day. Wind's pretty strong in that direction. That kind of messed us up in this particular trial. All right, so we weren't correctly accounting for those problems. So we missed the green buoy and then kind of keep going. Here's a kind of onboard view of one of the onboard cameras of that same trial. These are actually Hawaiian high school students, part of their gym class. Learn how to bail out a canoe. Part's a little slow. So we can fast forward. So there you can see the buoys we're trying to hit. We're going to miss the first one. But you can see some of the other contest things in the back. Right. See how the two different pontoons are floating, but our camera's staying a little bit more stationary than those pontoons. Pretty cool system. This same organization sponsors some other contests as well. They sponsors this contest that I think would be appropriate for you guys. We'll talk about in a second. So I think we do make it through this pairing of gates. Turn right, please. Thank you. Yeah, make it through that one. All right. So there's some stuff I've done. All that is just to set up what I think you guys can come join and work with us on. So I teach this class over in mechanical engineering called MEKI 201. It's called Introduction to Engineering Design. And it's taught to sophomore students, so kind of second year students nominally. Right? And really the idea is to teach this kind of design process through a series of robotics projects. So rather than just have the class and have you guys, when you get here, work through this class and just do stuff on paper and regular homework, actually have the students building robots the whole semester and working on the design ideas we're talking about in that class. Right? And if you're building a robot the whole semester, kind of makes sense you should have some kind of contest. Seems only fair to me. So we end the class in a robotics contest between teams of three students each. Right? So what do we use in that class? We actually use a custom kit that I've picked out from this company called SparkFun. It's a little microcontroller here. Looks like, I think I have two here I can send around for you guys to look at. So you see it's pretty tiny. Send it around. The processor on this guy is actually the same family of processors you might have in your iPhone or Samsung or whatever kind of phone you might have. Right, so it's an ARM processor. Right. We're actually able to write code in a kind of subset of this language, Python, called MicroPython. I think pretty easy language to learn, you guys. Most of my students that come through this class have not had the experience you guys are getting, learning some basic coding and those kind of things. So they're learning from zero. I think you guys are ahead of them. Whole kit's about $120. We kind of take care of that. And then we supplement. We give each team for the robot. This was the very beginning kit from 2015. We have a lot more stuff we give students right now. So we give each team about $750 worth of equipment to use on their robot that they kind of give back to us at the end of the semester. So getting some more stuff this term is going to be cool. A lot of example code, those kind of things, cool pictures. Ends in a robot contest like this. This is an overview of the similar class that I helped teach at Georgia Tech. So the class, the contest, you end up having four sides like this. Each team gets a color, right? And generally what you have to do, so you see the kind of robot on each side for the students. Generally you have to kick some stuff out of your zone and bring some stuff into your zone, put some stuff in the middle, those kind of things. Right? So you'll see, and then we have at the very beginning of the thing, kind of a science fair type presentation. So you see these kind of robots doing stuff. They're all pre-programmed. Right? Students in that class learn how to do some basic machining. We help them learn how to fabricate basic things. There's actually a presentation at the beginning. We have local companies actually come to this contest, talk to the students in a presentation. We do the same thing they do. They're doing kind of there. At Georgia Tech, they actually have, and we're kind of working on doing this, a separate contest for costumes and stuff like that with prizes. So students will really dress up. So you see each one of these robots is, you know, trying to knock some stuff out of the zone and gather, and it kind of has a theme every semester. We've had James Bond. We've had Mission to Mars. We've had Star Wars. So, an invitation, first of many invitations to you guys. Our final contest this semester is going to be Thursday, April 19th. We're going to start around 5 o'clock. So from 5 to 6 p.m., you can come talk to the students and judge them. They're going to present their designs to you, present to industry sponsors, other professors, whoever wants to come and judge them effectively. All right, so 5 to 6. Around 6 o'clock, the actual robot contest starts. All right, so teams of 3 or 4 students and come and start competing. That will last until around 8:30 at the latest. Okay. So I think what would be cool if you guys could join us, come to this contest, and then come see the contest this spring. And then this fall, you guys come and win the thing. You have your own teams and come and compete and beat my students, embarrass my students. Yeah. So I think that is a nice lead on from what you guys are learning. And you guys, like I said, you actually have a head start on where my students are starting, my sophomore students. You guys are learning more programming today than most of my students have. Right. So I think this is a nice progression. You guys come check the contest out. And then you have until next fall, working with us, to plan out your design and then come win the contest next fall. That sound cool? Yes?
If we win the contest, we get to go to Hawaii?
Yeah, so we're working on that, right? So this is the first step, right? I think I have a series of things for you guys. You win this contest, right? What you're set up to do is come be a part of another contest that we do. So we go, these guys actually don't go into space. So we've been here the last 4 years. We'll be going this fall. We have funding to go this fall too. And we'll keep getting funding, I think. So this is held out in the Black Rock Desert in Nevada. It's like 3 hours out into the desert from Reno, really the middle of nowhere. A bunch of Japanese teams come. They actually use it for the research stuff more than we do. Black Rock Desert, you can see kind of what it looks like there. That's the launch line. It looks like this more generally. So it's a dry lake bed. It's not a Saharan-type sand-based desert. Right? If any of you guys are motion sick, you don't want to watch the next video. So look away. We'll let you know when it's finished. So here's a launch of the rockets. We actually don't design the rocket. It's a partnership with this California Rocket Club. So they build the rockets. We pay them for their fuel, basically. So they get a free launch. They really like that. And then we get a launch, basically, without having to design a rocket. And these rockets are big enough where you need kind of special certifications and things like that anyway, that we don't have to worry about. We partner with those guys. So if you're motion sickness, look away. This is a camera looking down one of these rockets. They're pretty impressive. They go to 12, 14,000 feet in a hurry. So it gets up to its apogee. Right, and then the rocket splits into two pieces. Right, so we're getting pretty close to that now. You'll see the tail section got blown off. And then a little bit later, the robot that you guys get to design gets blown out of the rocket too.
And it has to land, doesn't it?
Has to land eventually. It's going to land eventually. It's coming down. So you see, your robot has to fit in that container. It's about this big around, almost 6 inches, almost 10 inches long. Yeah, so it's groups. There'll be Japanese teams will bring 10 people per group, things like that. Our teams have been 4 to 6 students. Right? So you have to go from there. There's kind of two different styles of presentation or competition. The first one is called CANSAT. Right? So your robot has to be the size and weight of a 12-ounce Coke can. So you have to make everything into that little tiny space, which is really hard, actually, if you're going to design it to drive around the desert, right? Which is what my team has done most of the time. There's another option to actually just have some kind of payload that fits in that volume that does something cool, right? So a lot of Japanese teams are actually researching aerospace applications, and they'll do like a mission. We're going to record data during when we're down, falling down, get information about the air quality and things like that. So here's some example designs. Here's the open class. This is what the UL teams have done so far. This is actually a high school guy from Montana. It has to find its way pre-programmed to some target on the desert. So you get GPS coordinates. Robot has to get spit out of the rocket and find its way to some target without you remote controlling it at all. A pretty challenging project. Here's one, guy during testing. It's a pretty simple little two-wheel design. This is one entry. So these guys design, you actually have a set volume you have to fit in the rocket, but it's better to have bigger wheels, right? So this team actually had these pneumatic wheels that when they landed, they blew up the big wheels, bigger wheels, and tried to drive. So you don't go back to where you launch from. There's a target usually about a mile away from the launch. Yeah. A question?
Were you the person where, like, you had told us about this and that one of them got stuck inside the parachute?
Yes. So you have to worry about if you're going to use a parachute, how do you get away from the parachute once you start driving and not get all tangled up in it? So here's another pretty cool example of that one. This is actually, see these kind of helicopter blades? It's not actually designed to fly, though. So it uses those blades to just kind of hop from one place to another. So it's kind of an interesting design. We sent a team, first ever team, a few teams. Let's kind of speed through that. So you see, we use parachutes typically. Okay. For you guys, I think to get started on this contest, to find a spot in the desert, that's hard for professional experienced engineers to do that. Right? I think you guys could do, however, a very, very cool mission-based CANSAT-sized one. So you learn about the microcontroller in 201, come beat my students in the fall, and then following on to that, you know how to use that controller now, and then we can add some cool sensors and GPS and a camera and take your designs out into the desert, get them launched up, and do some cool stuff on the way down from 12,000 feet. So here's actually another one of those rockets. How's that sound? Sound like fun, right? It is fun, I'll tell you. I've been out there a lot. It's a cool contest, a lot of fun, rockets. The rocket club out there is launching stuff the whole time. Not every rocket's for one of these CANSAT things. They launch interesting things. Somebody launched a grill one time. So it's kind of a fun place to be. And I think a really cool contest and a great experience as well. You can learn a lot, it's gonna be fun. So I think we have some cool stuff lined up that's going to help you guys out and be a lot of fun for you. So I'd be happy to answer any questions any of you guys have about any of that. It's all going to be fun, though. What's that? How often do we use gamepads to control robots? All the time. That's the easiest way for us to get really quick remote control up and working, right? So we don't have to, the joysticks all work pretty well. So no need to build that for ourselves. We just use that. Other questions? Nothing? I don't believe it.
First class?
Yes.
How high you shoot up the rockets?
The rockets, they will go between 12 and 14,000 feet. So they're high enough where you don't see the rocket anymore, basically. You hear it, but you don't see it. And then a parachute pops out, and it's just a one little small speck in the sky. Most people's robots break from this. Majority of them break, actually. What's that? Yeah, that's the idea. That we're going to build systems together. I think we're going to do groups, yeah. So I think doing something of this scale solo doesn't happen, really. Engineering is all about working in teams. Well, I think my job for my teams and for you guys is to be an advisor and a mentor and help you out. So I can provide tons and tons of help. But yeah, we'll be on you guys to kind of lead the way.
But are we like allowed to go even if we're not like, you know, experts in this?
Yeah, of course. The idea is to become an expert by doing this.
Yeah.
So that's what we're going to help you do. I have never designed anything personally that's left the atmosphere, no. So the contest is every September. Yeah, so, yeah, that we can figure that out in the future.